Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, December the 31st. Happy last day of 2007. We will talk this hour about the year that wasn't. Talk about some of the predictions, political predictions from various prognosticators, things that were supposed to happen in 2007 but did not. Like, remember when 2007 was supposed to be the year for GOP presidential candidate John McCain to lead the pack? Then it was going to be Fred Thompson to set the GOP on fire. Sam Brownback would matter, and it was Mike Huckahoo? And, of course, Ron Paul didn't really rate a mention. What happened there? 2007 was also supposed to be the year on the Democratic side that Hillary Clinton had already won the nomination, but on the other hand, Al Gore was going to run. What happened? None of these predictions really came true in 2007, and we will talk about why and welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest. Maybe you have some other examples of things that were supposed to happen that did not. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is David Weigel. He is associate editor of Reason Magazine, and he is the writer of the piece, The Year That Wasn't. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me, Joy.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. So that's right. Lots of predictions that just plain didn't happen.
A lot of presidential predictions are, you know, incredibly hard to make in good years. I mean, I guess it was every once in a while there's a race like, you know, Al Gore versus Bill Bradley that's easy to predict. But, you know, a certain amount of fluidity is to be expected. This year was just bizarre especially in the Republican side. I mean, the roller coasters go up and down, and we had, I guess, six candidates who all went up and down in a race that has just sort of spiraled. I mean, the guys are making less money than ever, except for Ron Paul. Everyone has had their moment at the top of the top of the race and has descended since then. I wouldn't say a myth of a McCain comeback now.
Yeah.
But McCain is getting this surge of publicity, and he's a little bit better in the polls, but he's about, you know, only polling 2/3 of what he was at the beginning of the year when we were supposed to be rolling out the carpet for his nomination.
Yeah, that's right. One of your items on this list of the year that wasn't, John McCain is the GOP frontrunner and the natural heir to Bush.
Mm-hmm.
So where did that come from? Where did that prediction come from?
That was a lot of good spin by people who worked for John McCain who either have known for years or got to know D.C. journalists. I mean, the smart people who work phones in D.C. and go to the right parties had just constructed this storyline that George Bush was sort of like William McKinley and John McCain was like Teddy Roosevelt. He was this guy that the people in power didn't quite like but saw as the best chance to continue their line for another 8 years. And this story just kept getting spooned out there to people, and it kept getting reported. It was a little bit self-fulfilling because when he was riding high, lots of people who worked in professional people working campaigns wanted to get on his bandwagon. And then as really like the second he disappointed in fundraising, they all jumped off. But it was really just, it was a matter of good hype. This campaign on the Republican side has been a lot like, you know, Hollywood trying to sell a bunch of the, you know, bad novel adaptations and saying, no, this one's really got the right stars. This one's got all the elements that you need from a hit.
Well, I want to name names here. You say, fittingly, the story of John McCain or the McCain campaign can be told in two glossy magazines, Esquire and GQ, that have perfected the art of the journalistic man crush.
Oh yeah, Esquire and GQ. When it comes to politicians, they never. I mean, they have excellent writers. I mean, guys who really can just sling prose like Billy the Kid slung a revolver. But they only ever fall deeply in love or deeply in loathe with characters, and they've fallen deeply in love with John McCain and Bill Clinton for about 8 years. So these profiles just exhibited this tendency in the media to anything John McCain did, even if it seemed odd or it seemed like a huge mistake that would kill his campaign, was actually a brilliant bit of maneuvering by this old West maverick with this, you know, glint in his eye and this boyish smirk. And oh, he was making this bold stand on immigration that was going to help him. He was making this bold stand on the Iraq War. Voters will reward that because they know he's got spunk and he believes this stuff. So these profiles that have been appearing in the big glossy magazines for years created this storyline of John McCain as this lovable maverick who even if he does wrong, the voters love that. And reporters just, for months and months, you know, whistled past this graveyard of him making really big mistakes and hurting his campaign.
Yeah. And you're saying that the turnaround in his media that is McCain's these days, you're not so sure this is a comeback?
Oh, he's doing better than he was 6 months ago, but he's doing far worse. He's in a worse position now than he was at the start of the year. He's basically trying to run a Hail Mary pass and win one state, blow through his campaign funds, and use the momentum to carry him through the rest of the primaries, which is, exactly what he did in 2000 that didn't work. He won New Hampshire. I mean, his plan back then was to win New Hampshire, surprise the world, use that momentum to win all these other states from Bush, but he ran out of money and got clotheslined. I mean, he just got, it was like a guy running down the field with the ball, and everyone jumped on him. And this is a race where there's not a huge front runner he has to knock down. There's just through four other guys with lots of money who are gonna pummel him. It's the same situation. The same kind of game he lost 8 years ago, and reporters are sort of ignoring that and saying, "Oh, now he's John McCain. He'll make a comeback. This is the best. This is the most incredible resurrection since Lazarus."
Then you wrote, "There was a moment when Washington was truly ready to accept Fred Thompson as the GOP frontrunner, as the natural candidate who could unite the party with charisma on loan from Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. All he needed to do was not flop, and he flopped."
He did. No one's quite sure. This is one of those stories that there are reporters, like for Newsweek and for Time, who, kind of like Teddy White used to do, cover the campaign but don't report their findings until it's over. Mm-hmm. And I think they will have the story of this, because it seems like Thompson, one, was never that interested in running for president and had a family, and specifically a wife who wanted him to run. And two, just had this grand scheme of how he would get himself ready. He had this in his mind, this kind of Rocky training montage where he was going to, you know, lose some weight and bone up on policy and take a lot of meetings and become this really, $6 million man candidate who'd come roaring into the race. And he had a window, really, of 4 months, and then he took 5 months to run because he just took so long to get into it. And once he got in, perceptions are important. I mean, just like John McCain benefited from the perception that he throws elbows and he's always going by his gut, Thompson built up this perception that he always had a perception he was kind of lazy, and then he took 5 months to run, and he's been angry that people keep treating him like he's lazy. That's why he never was able to shake that. I don't know what he could do outside of, like, you know, base jumping or, you know, skydiving to one of his Iowa events to prove that he is not completely decrepit and bored by this campaign.
Yeah, you didn't buy into this prediction when it came out.
I didn't. That was one thing I predicted a lot of things that were incorrect this year, but that one I got mostly right. Although I guess I also expected Obama to rise eventually, because I believe that if Hillary Clinton was the most famous Democratic woman in the world and was only, you know, polling 20 points above this guy, then he had to, you know, he there was a electorate ready to vote for him. Then I predicted Thompson, just by whenever he's got the 17-minute ad now that's similar to things he released before he ran, the 17-minute YouTube video that I think is going to be put on some TV screens. And he really sounds like a kid who hasn't done all of his homework and is trying to write a 1,000-page essay with, you know, 2 pages of notes. Mm-hmm. And he returns to the same themes again. He says we need to make the future better than the past, and it's a little bit painful to watch if you take pain in politician suffering, which I personally do not.
You say that one of the most respected political prognosticators in the business, William Safire, really blew it when it came to predicting who Hillary Clinton's running mate might be?
Yeah, that was bizarre, but that's an example of another example of the official Washington, although he's I guess beyond that now because he's a retired columnist, just sort of writing their own history of how this race is going to work and not looking at what the voters care about. Sapphire just has this went along with this idea that Hillary Clinton was a tough as nails hawk who was would be able to win the Democratic nomination because she'd muddy that issue, and he said she'd pick Rahm Emanuel as her running mate because he's also a hawk. And that, I guess, he made this prediction actually just about a month ago, just predicting that the Democratic base was willing to forgive any of the sins of the Clintons because they, I don't know why, because people like Sapphire have forgiven the sins of the Clintons in order for there to be a more hawkish, tough on other countries Democratic nominee. It just seemed like another example of somebody inserting their own version of events instead of into the news, and instead of looking at what Iowans and Democratic primary voters wanted. I mean, if we take him seriously, then he has no idea what the Democratic Party is up to.
Yeah. We are talking about The Year That Wasn't. That's the name of a piece by our guest, David Weigel, from Reason Magazine. He says 2007 was a year that defied conventional political wisdom. And we're talking about a lot of things that were predicted to happen politically in 2007, but did not. Maybe you have an example of that as well. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And what does this tell you? Why do we have such off-the-mark prognostications? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're tuned to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn. And it's all things political after 9. Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Washington correspondent for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, will join Veronica from Iowa, where he is covering the campaigns and the Iowa caucuses coming up in just a few days. So more political talk coming up after 9 o'clock this morning. By the way, Kathleen Dunn will be broadcasting live from Dubuque, Iowa on January 3rd and January 4th for the Iowa caucuses. She will be broadcasting from a cafe right now, filled to capacity, so otherwise I would let you know exactly where it is, but there's not going to be room for you. But you can listen along as Kathleen talks to Iowa caucus goers and some campaign spokespeople and other analysts and experts about the first-in-the-nation votes coming up on Thursday, January the 3rd. Kathleen broadcasting live from 9 to 11 a.m. on both Thursday, January 3rd, the day of the caucuses, and then on the 4th, the day after, to analyze the results. So we hope you will listen in for those special programs coming up later this week. David Weigel is our guest right now. He's associate editor of Reason Magazine, and he's writer of the piece, The Year That Wasn't. 2007 was supposed to be the year that John McCain would lead the GOP presidential candidates. Not at least for most of the year. It was supposed to be the year that Fred Thompson was going to be the savior. Well, that didn't happen either. Lots of predictions politically that happened that didn't bear out, and we're wondering why that is, and what examples you might have or insight you might have on why this happens. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, and please include your first name and your community with your email. Another prediction, David Weigel, was that Sam Brownback would be a factor in the GOP race, and that was wrong.
Well, this is wrong, though, for a little more more laudable reason the other predictions were wrong. And a lot of these predictions we talked about before, and the last one about Rahm Emanuel, you know, the Democratic conference chairman, rely on people just instead of reporting, just making predictions based on their guts, and you know, not kind of speculating late at night about what will happen instead of finding it out. Whereas the Sam Brownback interest, which had gone on for a while, was reporters digging and thinking, they trying to understand the evangelical voter, the Christian right Republican voter, and what motivated them, and what they would stood for in a, you know, in a declining Republican Party. I mean, not a permanently declining Republican Party, but a Republican Party that had lost the last election, with, you know, that had lost Rick Santorum and people like that. So reporters just thought Brownback's intellectually coherent, you know, supporting life from the cradle to the grave, from being against abortion to being for foreign aid in Africa, that this was an interesting philosophy and that Republican religious voters would support it. But they were wrong in that they just overthought it. I mean, the Republican, very few voters look for a completely coherent policy agenda like that. They look for a personality, or sometimes they're motivated by one really burning issue, like abortion. And Sam Brownback just frankly didn't have the personality of a Mike Huckabee, who could, you know, sell igloos to.
You bet, yeah.
I mean, he could you know, sell like Steelers hats in Green Bay. I mean, people thought, well, he's got all these disagreements with the Republican coalition, and he doesn't really stand for much beyond himself. But no, we've seen so many of these Iowa caucuses now since 1976, and it's the guys who warm up that crowd that succeed, and not the guys who explain, you know, why William Wilberforce gave us the lessons we need to have a coherent Africa aid policy. I mean,
yeah,
it's...
Yeah, yeah. So you think it's Huckabee's charm that is the reason behind his popularity right now? And that's it? It's just his charm?
That's 90% of the reason. I mean, he also is the only Republican candidate. Well, he and Ron Paul, in different ways, are the only Republican candidates who say that the economy is, in one way or another, not very good, and that rings a bell with Republican voters. Whereas Brownback was so theoretical that he seemed. I mean, he never talked about pocketbook issues. He just talked about these deep philosophical issues. Whereas Huckabee says, you know, you're Republican, and you also want your factory to be there in 10 years. Romney and Giuliani and these guys just go in there and say, the economy's great, let's cut taxes more and make it even better. And they lost a chunk of the more blue-collar Republican base because those guys just don't believe in it. But 95% of it is just personality. The guy is just an amazing salesman.
Yeah, but do you remember, you didn't write about this, but it was a former a Bush administration official, and I can't remember his name now, who said that Huckabee would never be elected because his name is too hick?
That was, Dan Bartlett who said that. Well, and Bartlett, you know, came up in Texas politics, but the newer generation, Tory Texas politician who they took the Republican Party over once the sort of Dixiecrat voters left the Democrats, and they are now in a lot of states like Texas surprised at who these voters are. They've been counting on their votes, but they're a little bit amazed when they want to elect a guys with funny names who talk about corporate greed and CEO pay. They're surprised when they call these people hicks, and they are just shocked when the voters who identify with them turn out.
Yeah. Back to the Democratic side, there was a lot of people were hoping that Al Gore would run for president. People were predicting that they really thought he would.
Yes, and I mean that they were, and that's the one that just gives me pause because it made so little sense. The theory of Al Gore running was not based on anything he was saying or a particular need in the Democratic Party. It was that he was winning lots of awards, and somehow winning lots of awards would translate into running for president. I mean, nothing like this had ever happened before. So everyone's just writing a fun story about whether this guy whether a Nobel Prize made it, you know, twice as likely or three times as likely that a guy would run for president. I mean, I felt a little bad for the guy. I mean, I'm probably the only person this year who felt bad for the guy because he was his mantle was collapsing from the weight of gold and glass on it. But he gets this Nobel Prize for his work on climate change issues, and he gives a statement about it, and he goes on the TV shows about it, and all anyone wants to ask the guy is whether he'd run for president. Yeah. I mean, nobody's asking about the penguins or the ice caps. the weird thing with the Al Gore thing, too, was that there were articles, I think I might link to one, about whether whether to watch his waistline and see if he started to drop some pounds, that meant he'd run for president.
I remember
And I mean, I guess that makes sense because it's exhausting. But that's another thing that's not how that's not how these things work. I mean, either if a guy doesn't want her to run, he's not going to run, and we could ask him about the other things he's interested in. The guiding principle of all these predictions is that political reporters get very bored basically every day and want a new story to chase down. But that was by far the weirdest and most untethered to reality story.
Yeah, it's an aside, not really related, but it reminded me of a satirical piece in the, it's called The Onion, a publication that has a lot of political satire. It just said, Al Gore wins Emmy, Oscar, and Nobel Peace Prize for slideshow. I thought that was funny.
that's what it was. And it was, 2 years ago, he was saying the same stuff, but he didn't have a slideshow. But then he builds a PowerPoint presentation, and he's ready to become leader of the free world again. I mean, another thing that really quickly that Al Gore benefited from is reporters love to compare things to previous races, mm-hmm. which is a useful exercise sometimes, but there are lots of comparisons between Al Gore and Richard Nixon, because Richard Nixon waited 8 years and made a comeback. But that's not even in apples and oranges. It's like apples and weapons-grade uranium. Like, there's nothing. That was what one politician did in a completely different media age with a completely different frame of mind. Everything was different about that. But it was just easier to write these quickie stories about what could happen rather than, I don't know, reporting on what Congress was up to or talking about, I guess, any of the issues that these guys try to raise. I mean,
remind listeners that we are talking about the political year that wasn't. Various political predictions or prognostications that just didn't happen. Al Gore didn't run for president, despite a lot of people saying he was going to. John McCain really wasn't the leader of the GOP. He might be staging somewhat of a comeback now, but he really almost was written off late in the year. The other one was that Mike Huckabee wouldn't go anywhere. Well, he is going somewhere. We're talking with our guest about the political year that wasn't, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for him. Why are so many of these political predictions, why were they wrong? What other predictions do you recall that were supposed to happen in 2007 but did not? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org. I think we might light up the phones a little bit with the next candidate who wasn't expected to go anywhere at all, and David Weigel, that Ron Paul's run for the presidency will be bad for libertarians. And what happened there?
Well, the Ron Paul campaign was one of the most analyzed like something in a petri dish as opposed to experienced. I mean, Ron Paul has been this figure on the libertarian right of politics for the better part of three decades, and he said he was exploring a presidential run, and libertarians are very used to nothing at all happening within their movement. I mean, with writing a couple op-eds and hoping somebody, somebody gives mention to the new Cato Institute report on privatization of toll booths and or the new, the new issue of Reason, but expecting that, libertarians, especially 72-year-old libertarian candidates who ran for president 20 years ago, are just not going to go anywhere. And Paul especially has, as somebody who's been on the right for all these years, has made some weird friends and said things have been tribute to him, or he said things that if Mitt Romney said them would really cripple his campaign. So there was all this debate about whether this guy should run and whether it'd be bad for people who believed in shrinking the size of government, getting rid of the Department of Education, pulling troops out of Iraq, would they be discredited by this guy's campaign? I mean, well, that really didn't happen at all. I mean, Ron Paul turned into the phenomenon of the race. And in a year, I think this quarter, which ends in a couple hours today, he raised $19 million. He's going to that breaks all the rules of how politics is supposed to work, because it turned out there were hundreds of thousands of people, and by the end of the primaries, maybe a couple million people who believe these things, and they're ready for a messenger to come along. It didn't matter that he was a little flawed, or his best campaign was a couple of years ago. It turned out people want people have beliefs, and they want a vessel for those beliefs.
Yeah, and now it looks like in Iowa, they're talking about whether Ron Paul or John McCain will come in at number three, and much attention is being made to the number three spot in Iowa.
Yeah, the Iowa Independent, which is this good new online reported magazine that's been around since May, has been predicting Paul will come in third for a while, just because his supporters are so intense. And I think traditionally you get three tickets stamped out of Iowa. I'm not sure when the tradition started, although I know that Mike Dukakis was maybe the earliest beneficiary of it, because he was from Massachusetts. He came in third behind Dick Gephardt and Paul Simon. He spun that as a big win. And McCain or Paul or Giuliani, if he lucked out there, would spin it as a win. But the reporters who actually are on the ground, I mean, this is another thing of reporters seeing reality and changing their predictions. If you asked them in February, they would have said, he's crazy and not going anywhere. But by the summer, Bob Novak, who's been in the game since the 50s and really knows politics, was saying, hey, look, this guy's crowds and his supporters are by far the most, they're like Beatlemania. They're the most crazed and devoted supporters out there. And Iowa, because it's a very weird voting system, is all about crazed supporters who are willing to stand in the cold and spend 3 hours in a room voting. So maybe he can have this.
Yeah, we did a program on Ron Paul when he was raising the record amount of money on the internet and getting lots of volunteers on the internet. It was one of your colleagues, I think it was Nick Gillespie, talking about the Ron Paul phenomenon, bringing up a little bit one of the areas we talked about were some controversial writings in a newsletter regarding race. And when Gillespie talked about how that this was a controversy in Ron Paul's campaign, boy, did we get deluged from Ron Paul supporters saying that we were not being fair to Ron Paul. You talk a little bit about these writings on race. What about that?
Well, nobody has ever found a tape or a video of him saying something racist, but he, again, has been a celebrity on the libertarian right, on the old right, since the 70s, and he has had newsletters written by different people, some of them who are still working, some of them who are not, and from the 80s, there was a letter that had some digressions about how blacks in D.C. are fleet-footed and 95% of them have criminal instincts. And this stuff was first dredged up in 1996 when he was making a comeback. He'd been out of politics for a while, and he was making a comeback for the House, and his opponents dredged this up. And from what I found, I mean, I talk about whenever there's a Paul scandal. I mean, there's also this white supremacist website called Stormfront, whose founder gave Paul some money. I'll point this out, and I'll get the facts on it. But the supporters, I think, have moved from really fretting and biting their nails about this to saying, well, gee, if the best they can dredge up is something that happened 11 years ago, mm-hmm. or even an allegation from 11 years ago of something that happened 8 years before that, then the guy's as, you know, pure as Caesar's wife. I mean, it's as we thought. He actually has Paul's supporters, almost more than anyone, I think, except for Obama supporters, are stick to him because they think he's incredibly principled and honest. And if there's no tape of him saying anything bad, and the only things people can attribute to him saying anything bad are from all those years ago, then they're like, wow, I'm right. And this guy is unlike any other politician. He's how do you spend 11 years in Congress and nobody and may not make any new mistakes for people to attack you for?
And you write in your piece that the mainstream media has grown more interested in libertarianism, all of it, not just Ron Paul's brand, and has generally ignored Ron Paul's controversies.
It has, because they're just not interesting. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of time of the day, and news organizations have a certain amount of people who work for them who can embed with campaigns. And, I mean, unless we saw this with Mike Huckabee. Like, Huckabee didn't receive any real scrutiny until he surged in ahead of the polls in Iowa, in one state that he conceivably win. So, I mean, Paul's campaign at 8% in the polls is just an interesting story about who these people who've been thinking this way, thinking libertarian thoughts, not trusting the government, not wanting a one-world government, who they are, why they think this way. And if he keeps getting these, you know, chunks of the vote but not winning anything, then there's no reason for them to focus on these aspects of his past. I mean, that sort of trivial, bone-digging stuff doesn't really matter unless reporters are putting the heat on somebody who could possibly be president. Right now, he's just the vessel and the spokesman for a movement, and you cover somebody like that different than you cover a front runner.
Yeah. Dan in Viroqua, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Morning. Yeah, I'd just like to say that, you know, even this discussion that you're having is somewhat part of the problem. I mean, just basically focusing on the fact that anybody who's on the so-called fringe, like Ron Paul or Dennis Kucinich, or even Ralph Nader or somebody like that, that can't get elected or, you know, has a long shot to get elected. I truly believe that that stuff's going to come to an end because people are so sick of this. Mm-hmm. And we really need new blood in there. And this whole dynastic thought that seems to have taken over the national political scene is, frankly, I can't stomach it anymore. And I even hear it on public radio. And
So why is this conversation a part of the problem, Dan?
Well, I mean, you're basically already putting it in a light that the guy can't get elected.
No, we didn't say that at all, did we?
No, I'm saying reporters are covering him differently because political reporters don't think he's going to get elected. I'm not vouching any of my opinions. I've been surprised by everything Ron Paul's done, so I'm not saying anything. I'm not predicting this race for it's over.
Yeah.
When the hosts or when you're talking about these fringe guys, it's almost like an afterthought that, you know, this can't happen. Well, I bet it is a long shot, but I mean, as long as people have that mindset that, oh no, these guys don't have a snowball's chance in Hades, it'll never happen. But I truly believe that people want a real change, and the things that are going on in Washington, you know, the Patriot Act and stuff like that, people want their rights back, and I can't blame them. And frankly, I'm really sick of the political establishment. And, I really hope he does well. I really hope that he goes far, because I really want these bums in Washington out. Mm-hmm. I don't care if they're Democrat or Republican. I mean, I'm sick of it.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan. And there goes, it kind of proves the point that a lot of people didn't think maybe Ron Paul would go anywhere, but he has a deep support from people like Dan.
He does, and I think what he was saying is, I've heard before, it's almost sounds like somebody coming out of a shock, because I was doing a story about how states where Ron Paul could do well in these primaries, and talked to some organizers and people handing out petitions and knocking on doors, and these are people who've worked on libertarian campaigns or third party campaigns or what have you, and they're used to coming in, you know, third place with 2% of the vote. So I talk about how they could actually win the thing, and their minds go back to, well, we can win if the media start to take us seriously, and you know, people need to know that this we can win, and they need to stop dismissing us. And I kept having to repeat myself and say, but I'm not dismissing you. I mean, what you've done so far, you've raised $19 million in 3 months for the guy. Like, this is no longer one of those, it's a hard campaign, but it's not a quixotic thing anymore. You've broken all the rules, and you've actually got a chance with all this money. And I'd hear, yeah, but we need to start getting some good coverage. And it's I think maybe in 4 years, if the Ron Paul movement or something like it continues, now that people know that a candidate who gets no respect from the mainstream media can raise millions and, you know, humiliate, you know, Rudy Giuliani. I mean, Rudy Giuliani and John McCain are going to raise half of what Paul does if they're lucky. Now that people know that that's within their power to do it, I think they might know what to do a little bit better if it happens again.
Yeah. We are talking about political predictions that didn't happen, the political year that wasn't, 2007. One of those, the prediction or the prognostication that Ron Paul wasn't going to go anywhere. Well, that was wrong, and we're talking about it being wrong. And we're talking about other predictions like Al Gore will run for president. Well, that didn't happen. John McCain would be the GOP front runner. Well, that didn't happen. Fred Thompson will then become the GOP front runner. Well, that didn't happen. There are others on this list of the political year that wasn't. David Weigel, our guest and the writer of this piece, associate editor of Reason Magazine. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, it's All Things Political. Veronica Rickard in for Kathleen Dunn, talking about the latest political news, including the campaigns in Iowa and the first caucuses coming up on Thursday. Veronica talking with Craig Gelbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who's also in Iowa, about that coming up in our next hour. We're talking about all sorts of things that were supposed to happen in 2007 that did not, with our guest David Weigel, associate editor of Reason Magazine. Our next caller is Ruth in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Yeah, good morning, Joy. You know, I have my own little theory about why these predictions aren't coming true, you know, because if you listen to the people, you get one thing, and if you listen to the party leaders, you get something else, you know. And we seem to always end up with the what the party leaders want for the country and not really what the people want for the country. And to be honest with you, I'm not convinced that there's two, that there's actually a Democratic Party leader and a Republican Party leader. I have a feeling, I have a nasty, icky, sinking feeling that there's one person who picks, you know, the person who's going to best represent that position from both sides, and that's who we end up with as our candidate. The party leaders control so much in terms of access, media access, and in a lot of ways funding and whatnot, and it just, it makes me crazy that we are not being able to elect the people that are best for the people, that the people want.
David, you want to react?
I think that's less true now than it's ever been. I mean, if you go to the very start of the primary process, the first contested presidential primaries were Estes Cafalver versus Harry Truman, and Truman lost these primaries when he was in the incumbent president, and then they had a Democratic convention, and they chose Adlai Stevenson. I mean, in the beginning, there were party bosses who literally filled up rooms with smoke and talked about who should be their candidate. And, I mean, Barry Goldwater was one of the first real people-powered candidates who shocked the establishment, and they almost blocked him. They would have if Goldwater's people hadn't understood the delegate rules. So I think one of the reasons all these predictions have gotten wrong is because power, political power, more and more and more is getting devolved and pulled away from political establishments to average people. I mean, that's 20 years ago, there could not have been a Ron Paul campaign because the Republican Party would have been able to block him from debates. He wouldn't have gotten on, the newscast, the nightly newscast had never covered the guy. There was a Ron Paul campaign in 1988. He only raised, I think, about $5 million over the whole year. And now people can get news from the Internet and basically create their own diet of media, decide what's important to them. They can, click, just like they can click on Amazon, or they can pay their parking ticket online. They can go and click his website and give money to him. So just like we saw with Howard Dean 4 years ago, is another guy who lost, but after Howard Dean lost, he took over the Democratic Party. I mean, I think we're slowly, not too slowly, I just talked about two events that were 4 years apart, and we've come a long way since then. But it's not like, storming the Bastille sort of change. It's incremental, every couple of years change we're seeing in this. As technology makes it easier for people to get involved with politics, I think they're taking power away from the sort of people you're talking about. I really do. I mean, I think we'd be talking about a McCain-Hillary race like right now if those people decided how this stuff works.
Yeah, whatever. And that David from I don't know where in an email wants to know about the predictions for Hillary. Why isn't she on her way to the White House already? She was already anointed the nominee for the Democratic Party, and now we're not so sure.
It's just as simple as that. Mm-hmm. Iowans and people in New Hampshire met her and didn't fall in love with her. She's like I've said earlier. She is the most famous Democratic woman in the world, Democratic Party politician in the world, probably. Certainly, if you discount her husband because he can't get elected to anything anymore, or he can't be president anymore, but she had never campaigned in Iowa. Not really. Her husband had not campaigned there in 1992 because Senator Tom Harkin was running for president, and everyone left it to him. So she went there, and she made a very, very poor argument for most of the campaign. If you're covering this, you get memos from her campaign pollster, and they would just brag about their huge leads and how nobody. They had one memo early on about how nobody with a lead this big had ever lost the nomination before. So they made a very arrogant argument. I mean, it reminds me what the last caller was talking about. It was almost like they were trying to tweak that nerve and say, I know you don't like us, but you got to get used to us. We're going to decide this nomination. And Iowans got to see all these candidates, and actually, I think increasingly, they're looking at a guy they voted for, like that the media wasn't even covering, John Edwards. He got to cover Newsweek last week, but he wasn't getting the kind of coverage Obama and Clinton were because they meet these people and they make their own decisions. So she ran an arrogant campaign. I don't like to predict. I mean, I want to see what happens in this race. She's running a better campaign now, but it was a matter of people reading polls and using their own judgments about how the Clintons were this devious campaign geniuses, mm-hmm. versus them actually meeting real voters who decide this stuff.
Yeah, and at least the real voters will start anyway in Iowa in just a few days, and it's just whoever would have thought that it would be a three-way tie, really, essentially a dead heat between Clinton and Obama and Edwards.
I like this. I'm a little perplexed, too, because the reporters in Iowa, I mean, I'm going to New Hampshire, I'm not going to Iowa, but I have friends who are, and they love covering this three-way race, and they love covering this really fractious thing on the Republican side. So I read their stuff, and I sort of smack my forehead, and I think, well, why were you guys trying to write the end of the race 6 months ago?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you saying Hillary's inevitable? Part of it's because people like to create these comeback stories. I mean, if McCain had been rolling towards the nomination as opposed to kind of stumbling and falling apart and then dusting himself back up. That's a better story. But why were they? It seemed like whenever people want to be the first to declare the end of something and say that somebody's won. I mean, yesterday we saw this football game, and it did. On Saturday we saw this Patriots Giants game. I remember Giants fans were selling their tickets because they were so convinced that their team was going to lose. They ended up losing, but it was one of the most. I mean, they almost won the thing. It was one of the closest football games of the year. It's not a good idea generally to take a little bit of evidence and say, "Oh, well, this is over. I'm not even going to pay attention."
Well, one of the predictions from some of the prognosticators is that on the GOP side, in particular, in this race for president, that this is going to maybe come down to the convention, and maybe somebody like Michael Bloomberg will still end up running and as an independent because there's so much dissatisfaction. What do you make of those predictions?
Well, the convention one is interesting because it actually relies, unlike many things, on math and on David Ferdoso, who's a National Review's political reporter, I think, the conservative magazine's political reporter, I think, is the first guy I saw who just took out a notepad and wrote down, well, if all the guys who are ahead in the polls in these primary states in the Republican race won right now, then none of them would have a majority. And that's not happened. The closest we've come to that in recent history was 1976 when Reagan and Ford were fighting for defense until the last minute. I think that's possible. I think the Mike Bloomberg thing is unrelated to it. That's something I'm working my head around because, I mean, the Ron Paul campaign, I think, is the real phenomenon of the year. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me in some ways of the Ross Perot campaign. Although Perot, when he started running for president, was more famous. He was famous for, you know, trying to send Christmas packages to POWs and a lot of kind of quirky heroics he'd done. But these were candidates that voters discovered and turned into contenders. I mean, in Paul's case, it's been money. In Perot's case, it was people volunteering to get him signatures. Bloomberg is just sort of running this top-down, I wouldn't call it a vanity exercise, but it's very imperial and sort of he's waiting with his, you know, he's got his foot on the gas pedal. He's not pushing down until they choose their candidates.
Yeah.
It's very cynical, and it's not really based on anything other than the idea that people are tired of this election and want somebody to sweep it all away for him. I don't know. This is so fractious that I think he's going to be disappointed. Voters have a belief. They don't just want easy solutions.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks a lot for inviting me.
David Weigel is associate editor of Reason Magazine and writer of the piece, The Year That Wasn't. Thanks to Leo Duran and to Christina Taylor for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.